Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 11, What's My Motivation?, directed by Lynn Shelton, and including guest cast Tia Sirkar, Eugene Cordero, Rebecca Delgado-Smith, Amy Okuda, Susan Park, Rumen Kazi, Will McLaughlin, Josh Siegel, Jen Statsky, and introducing Mark Evan Jackson. In this episode, Tahani helps Eleanor try to achieve the maximum number of points before the judge, Sean, arrives. Eleanor realizes that she has a corrupt motivation of self-preservation in her good deeds, and that ultimately the only way for her to earn points is to self-sacrifice. Chidi is unable to respond to real Eleanor's declaration of love to him. Michael discovers that Jianyu is actually Jason due to his marriage to Janet. Just as Eleanor is about to turn herself into Sean, Janet offers an alternative option of the medium place, and they escape with Jason on Sean's train. In a flashback, we see how Jason died in a safe while trying to rob a restaurant with his friend Pillboy. My guests today are writer of the episode, Andrew Law, and costume designer, Kirsten Mann. Kirsten and Andrew, welcome. Everything is fine.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much for being here. Kirsten, we could do multiple episodes just about the wardrobe and costumes on this show. You've worked with Mike lots of times on other shows.
Yes, I have.
And was this one different?
It was. They're all equally enjoyable.
Super diplomatic answer.
Yeah, exactly. I've done Parks and Rec, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which he co-created with Dan Gore, and now The Good Place. As a costume designer, this was the most exciting script because I've had a lot of freedom to deal with what is the good place, what is the bad place, to tease apart different worlds and to tease apart the different characters in a very big way because they come from different places and we're trying to tell a story that the underlying story is something completely different.
Right.
So it's been really fun.
What was your first call with Mike or your first meeting on this one when he said, oh, we're doing this thing, it's set in the afterlife? What happened next?
Well, he sent me the script, and of course, you know, the first time you get a script, you're trying to figure out the whole season, or I am constantly like, what is the, what
is underneath it?
Just the pilot script, and it's all about the good place, so it's not telling you that there actually is a bad place or that this is, that this might have some kind of edge to it.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, though, he let you in on that early, right?
He did not.
Oh.
It was top secret. But I kept trying to egg him on, like, did you ever see that episode of The Twilight Zone where the guy kept winning with the lottery? He was a gambler and he kept winning. Do you remember that? And he was actually, and Mike was not taking the bait at all. He was basically blew me off. And I said it to Drew as well. Like,
Drew Goddard, yeah.
Because I was thinking, can this be this level of good?
Throughout.
Could this be? You know, could this mistake actually be? So I was so curious if The Good Place had any underlying current. But Mike was so top secret about it. I think he told the actors, but he definitely did not tell me.
We've learned that he told Kristen and Ted, but did not tell the other actors until about three quarters of the way through the season.
Right.
Andrew, you knew about it.
I knew about it.
You were you day one in the writer's room?
Yes, I was. And yeah, I think he told us about it, I think on the first day, maybe on the second or something like that. But he sent us home with like the pilot script. We read it, and then he filled us in pretty soon after that.
Now, wait a second. How does this process work? Like, you have an agent that will bring you opportunities. Do you get like a one sheet that it says? I mean, first of all, you get something saying Mike Schur wants to hire you, and you go, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty much it. Right. It was. I was working at Late Night with Seth Meyers at the time.
I've heard of it.
And I flew out to LA to meet with Mike. And
you were living in New York.
I was living in New York.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it was the Friday right before Christmas break.
Oh wow.
And I was like, oh, I'm on this top secret mission. I'm going to to meet with him. And of course, when I got there, he was already like, oh, Seth and Shu, I already talked to them about this. And I was like, oh God, am I in trouble? But he was. He was so kind and nice, and the meeting went great. And so
you hadn't met him before.
I had not met him before, but I was so interested in this because of his track record of amazing shows. And so in January, I heard that that he wanted to hire me, and so I moved out to LA. And yeah, with not much of an idea of what was going on. I mean, he had said in our meeting that he liked that I had, you know, a background in philosophy because I had studied some of it in college.
Is that true?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I majored in political philosophy, so it's a different branch of philosophy.
Sure.
But I didn't read a lot of the things that we ended up reading. It was still, interesting enough for him. And then he showed us the pilot script, which sort of was when most of us, like, got the premise. And then I think shortly after that, he told us about the twist at the end.
How shortly?
I think pretty soon after. I think it was always his plan from the beginning. I could be wrong.
It was.
I have the worst memory in the world. But I think that it was maybe like, you know, second day that he told
us
about
it.
Yeah, and he also like sort of teased out the other sort of twists throughout the season. Like that, you know, Eleanor was going to confess pretty early on in the season, which is going to change everything. And then that Jason wasn't supposed to be there either. So it was, I don't think he knew exactly who Jason was, maybe. I think we figured that out as a room, but I think that he wanted to have these like sort of steps leading up to the big reveal where, you know, something's off here and something's off there. And then you sort of figure it out.
We've learned that, a lot of what Jason became also, came from Manny. Like once
you
put a face to it, that informs a ton of it, right?
Well, I remember actually one of our tasks early on, like, probably first few weeks, was to help write the sides for the dummy sides. And it was very interesting. And I think that was probably the first thing that I actually helped on at the show is me and Joe Mandy like working on sides for Jason. And it was it's very funny to think back on it now. And like to think back that we were just basically writing temp dialogue that was never going to be shot, but that it, you know, was eventually going to go to some actor who was then going to embody that character. But yeah, it was probably more Joe than me, to be honest.
I was away on a movie and helped. I saw those dummy sides in like January of 2016 because I was helping a friend reading for Gianyu, Jason Mendoza. When you see this dummy size, you kind of go like, what is this show? Like,
totally.
This is really weird.
Yes, it's very strange. Like, I remember, like, we were also like, how dumb is Jason? Like, how dumb do you make this character?
All the way.
And actually, some of the stuff, I think, from those sides have come back in certain scenes and episodes and stuff.
I remember it distinctly. I remember the strange, like, you know, reaching higher and ambition of, like, it's a misdirect of, I don't want to just be a DJ in Jacksonville.
Right.
Maybe Tampa. Maybe. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Kirsten, why, at what point did sort of a, I guess, retro motif, not just for the architect's office in the 1950s or 60s, but like starting with Michael, I guess. Why? Michael's a bit of a dandy. He's often very nattily dressed.
Yes.
Some of his bow ties are made of feathers, I think, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I think on the first episode, we used the feathered bow tie. You know, initially, Michael was going to be professorial, and we know him as initially as somebody who is this good guy who's an architect, and he built this great place for the humans. And he's like a professor who loves all things human. So, mm-hmm. like, he would like all the little knickknacks and things that we love to play with. He had a fascination for that kind of thing. So using the bow tie, like, it would make sense that if he's watching, you know, things on Earth, that would be something that he would be drawn to. Mm-hmm. And honestly, when we were in the fitting with Ted, initially we probably would have gone more the professor route, the tweedy coat.
Right.
But as we were trying on looks and we had bow ties and ties and all kinds of things, he put on the bow tie and completely felt like, this is it. This
it
is
him. It informed him. He felt that way, or you felt that way?
We both felt that way. Okay. And that's like, you know, when that happens in a fitting room, that feels really
you can feel
good.
It.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, Ted had his character, but so he knew inside what it felt like.
You're crediting yourself and the bow tie for Ted's performance. Is that what's happening?
Yes. That's Ted's joke to me. That's why I'm trying to clarify.
Well,
it
actually,
was Ted's pick.
I have a question about that, actually. Is the idea of, like, the bow tie, I mean, it works so well, I think, also because it makes him seem so harmless and innocuous. So
yes.
Right when the big reveal happens.
It is disarming.
Did you have that in mind when you chose that piece of clothing?
No, because I wasn't sure about the big reveal. But Ted was aware.
Oh, sure. I see. That's interesting. That would have...
So I won't take credit at all, but it circled around to perfection, I feel. And then we have moved on to different ties as we're
right.
progressing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Janet, because that's such a specific, what do you even call it, a vest skirt suit, her ensemble? Like, did
yes.
you consider other things before you dialed in that look? How would you frame that look? What is it?
When I read the first script, I had Janet in my head. I felt very clear about what she looked like because when I was younger, I used to fly alone, and the stewardesses were like these now airline hostesses, but back in those days,
sure.
they were like goddess creatures, human, you know,
yes.
to me. They helped me. And so I had her as this person who, you know, that lives in the sky, as far as I was concerned, as a 5 and 6-year-old.
Oh, my goodness, it's perfect.
And so I really saw her like that.
Yeah.
And then Mike is so generous to all departments and letting them be creative. And he was in. He was game. And then we found fabrics that we felt like would work perfectly. And and I love the color purple because somehow it means unity to me. And especially, I think, you know, during like election red, blue states.
Right, yeah.
So there's just like something where it's like a little more harmonious that she's not taking any sides, that she's just purely
sure.
giving out her information and all sorts of things to everybody.
I feel like Michael's plaids often have a little purple in them too. Like I feel like there's some purple in Michael as well.
Yeah. I do a lot of pinks and blues and those are just in my wheelhouse of love colors.
How many Janet's outfits have you designed? Because, for instance, in the reboot episode in season 2, you went through billions. Do you know how many you've done?
You know, I'm so glad you said billions. We probably did 10 to 12.
Is that all? Really? It feels like at least twice that.
And then we made multiple shirts. So we kind of worked around that. But I'm going
to
go with
to.
Billions.
Do you like, is it, are you thinking like thematically for a season, like we're going to make this type of, you know, suit for Janet because of like something that's coming up or is it just something that you want to give her some variety or?
Well, generally since season 1, Janet has been mainly in her purple suit.
And sort of a floral blouse.
It's a white blouse with blue clouds.
Okay.
And we picked the clouds, you can guess why, and then the purple suit. So then in the season where we were rebooting her, we did so many different looks, and then we kind of landed back at purple. We did
I
land
see.
Back at purple. Although throughout, you know, when we go to the Janet warehouse, Janet is in white. When we see bad Janet, we see a different Janet.
Well, I want to talk about bad Janet.
We love Bad Janet.
Oh my goodness. What's the if Good Janet is a 60s, 70s airline hostess, what is Bad Janet? Sort of disco? How would you frame it?
For me, in my mind, and I don't even like saying this because I feel like I don't know what it is to Mike who and to Darcy, but she's Olivia Newton-John in Grease.
Oh, my goodness. Wait, that's exactly who she is. And I'm ashamed I never saw that before, of course.
So when I read Bad Janet, you know, I mean, that it's like a good girl trying to be bad, you know, you're the one that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, she jumped out off the page like that for me.
That's hilarious and so perfect. Andrew, in this episode, there's some low-key torture, as there always is. There are a lot of opportunities that are taken to make it worse for our four humans. But there's some really interesting sort of strategery that goes on. Like Michael pretends not to know that Jianyu is actually Jason, but I don't feel like he knew. Like, I think he's legitimately confused that Janet and Jason got married, right?
Yes.
That's news, right?
Yeah. What's so funny is rewatching it back. Mm-hmm. I watched it last night because it's been 2 years and I do not remember anything. But basically, I was watching it with the lens of now after the reveal and everything.
Of course, yeah.
And we were writing it that way too, but it's different after you've actually seen, like, you know, Ted Danson laughing that sinister laugh.
Yeah.
And it was so strange because you are thinking to yourself, like, how much does he know and how much does he not? And I do think it's a legitimate surprise to him that they're wearing wedding bands and that he has, like, two frozen yogurts and that he is, you know, trying to hide this marriage from, you know, Michael, who he thinks is Janet's dad.
oh, my God. He's so dumb.
He's so dumb.
So dumb.
There's no bottom to his idiocy.
Even after having been told, not my dad.
Yes.
I'm not a girl. All that stuff.
Yes.
But not my dad. Like, that happens at least three times.
What's very satisfying to me is, like, he says that Michael is Janet's dad. Mm-hmm. But at some point during the episode, he starts calling Michael
dad. Yeah, right.
And you realize that in his head, the logic that he's put together is that he should call this person who is his father-in-law dad without having asked him, I guess.
Sure.
But anyway, he is legitimately surprised, I think, that they're together. He's not. But he's feigning surprise that, you know, Jason is actually not who he says he is.
Right, that's gamesmanship. That's
exactly.
Yeah, a lie.
And it's also very interesting seeing Vicky in this episode because obviously in season two, we see how much of an overactor she is and how incredibly, like, method. And, I mean, she's sort of like a parody of the capital A actor, right?
Sure.
With her, like, vocal warm-ups and her accents and stuff.
Accents and limps.
Yeah, exactly. And all the choices she's making. And it's very interesting to see her in this one actually be very convincing and good and as real Eleanor.
Oh, my goodness.
And really torturing Chidi by saying, I love you, and knowing that he can't say it back.
Him responding to the egg is just the saddest.
I know.
Pop-out. Like, it's so sad.
Yeah. It's so funny. It's actually, like, I know that there are people who really pay attention to a lot of the food in Mike's shows.
Oh.
Like, there's a whole, like, Tumblr about the food in Parks and Rec. And
what?
There's,
Because of, like, the fat burger, the whatever the...
I think there is a lot of food references in Parks and Rec, but, like, in our show,
waffles.
Too. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it's funny that, like, people track what our characters like to eat, and eggs is like a cheaty thing, and shrimp is an Eleanor thing.
Sure.
And it's very interesting to sort of keep that in the back of our minds when we're writing, like, you know, future episodes of, like, okay, what would they order here or whatever, and because people actually seem to care about it.
I think William Jackson Harper hates eggs.
Really?
And quinoa. I feel like I've heard him say that more than once.
I can see that.
Yeah. I love that you take the opportunity in this episode to do a little fun E&E entrance and exit with Janet, like some, you know, to take the opportunity Mike talked early on about, you know, exploiting the infinity that exists in the afterlife so that she pops in and out as such a fun and dumb slapstick game.
Like, yeah. It is kind of right. It's like Abbott and Costello.
It is, right?
Type.
Yeah,
like for the 21st century or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, and it's also funny, I think, like, because, well, when we were first conceiving of Janet, I think it was, I mean, I know that Mike had to sort of make a lot of decisions as to, like, how she would actually be depicted and how Darcy would play her, because you can get into like robot Siri territory, which, you know, is kind of weird and also like it's maybe too much of a parody of like the AI that we have now. But at the same time, it is kind of funny that like you can like be doing something on your phone and then all of a sudden you say the wrong thing, or you say like, you know, you're trying to say something else and you accidentally say Alexa, and then all of a sudden she's trying to help you or something like that, and she pops in and pops out.
Right.
So I think that that's maybe where that came from. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the moment where she's like, who, me? No. Bye. Just delicious.
She's so good at that.
Just before that, she does a weird thing. She says, I've evolved. I now understand love and I can do this. And she marries her fingers together and does some sort of thing. What did the script say?
I don't remember. I don't.
You wrote it,
Andrew. I don't know if that was. Was that in the table draft? Does anyone know? Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't remember. I truly don't remember. But it is kind of funny, right? Because that moment is sort of teasing what happens in season two, I think, where, you know, it's a joke in season one that she can sort of make her hands do a certain thing that, like, kids do.
Right.
But then by season two, she's gotten all of these new abilities and feelings and emotions, and really tracking her from seasons one and two, she's becoming more human.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny that it sort of starts with her being able to make worms out of her fingers.
Right.
But that eventually, you know, she actually gains emotions and feelings.
Making worms out of fingers is a great way to frame that. It's difficult to describe the wiggling on the radio.
Yeah.
Kirsten, we asked the internet, we asked the universe about questions, and there are tons. One of my friends said, she asked, Eleanor frequently is wearing sort of a cloggy mule type shoe, and my friend is very concerned she's going to sprain her ankle. Is that ever a concern of yours or of Kristen's? And why those shoes?
That was the good Eleanor wearing those shoes. And what's funny is both Kristen and I actually wear clogs in real life.
Okay.
And so we're good at walking in them and have been for years.
So you're showing off.
Yeah. Kristen is. I'm not. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting here. I'm actually wearing clogs right now as
confirmed.
We speak.
Oh my goodness, confirmed.
So no, I don't think she's going to twist her ankle. But you know, why did she wear them? So we made good Eleanor, and I hope that people could see this. The Eleanor that we see in Arizona is a little bit more of a party girl, I'll say,
for sure,
and a little bit more of a wild dresser,
mm-hmm.
where the closet that she inherited when she arrived at the good place was supposedly the good Eleanor's,
and she
is the imposter for that. So she ends up wearing flannel shirts, clogs, and jeans that don't really belong to her and wouldn't be her natural.
Right, she didn't go to University of Michigan Law School.
She did not.
Yeah.
And so she is wearing somebody else's clothes. So when she starts wearing her own clothes, and whenever we see her as Eleanor, the Eleanor Shellstrop that we know,
mm-hmm.
she isn't wearing clogs. So this was just like the good person's clogs.
Oh, my goodness. That's a whole nother level of...
Mm-hmm. So she was just a little bit more earthy.
Wow. Another question was whether Tahani's wardrobe was informed by Jamila in real life at all.
Absolutely.
Because they're not dissimilar. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Wow.
She came into the fitting with a suitcase. She Ubers, so she dragged it far. She brought us lots of dresses for us to look at and look at silhouettes on her.
Mm-hmm.
And some of her dresses we patterned, you know, we made a pattern of her dress of a silhouette that we liked and then used fabric that we wanted to use. And we also had a rack of sort of these dress. I mean, she looks amazing in this, in everything.
Sure.
A. But B, in that particular silhouette. And we make a lot of things for
her.
What
is it? It's sort of a flouncy skirt. It's not quite an pure waist, but it's higher, right? It's kind of belted anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
She has a very narrow waist. I mean, she has a great figure, so everything looks good on her.
At the first table read, I remember she came in a big sort of floral dress.
Yes.
And I remember it was like kind of like, you know, everyone was nervous because we hadn't read the script yet and this executive's there. And then I remember she just like entered with this like gown on. And I was wondering, is that her dress or did you make that?
Her dress.
Oh, I see.
And she definitely has a closet full of dresses that look very similar to Tahani's closet.
Oh,
and
wow.
Somebody recently told me they saw – I mean, that years ago they saw her at a pool party and, you know, it was like a casual California barbecue. And they were like, who is that woman? You know, she was just in this glamorous gown at a barbecue. And she so easily pulls it off and you – never looks out of place.
It doesn't
you know.
Look formal on her.
No.
It doesn't look like you showed up in a tux to a, you
No, it looks like somehow if I put that on, it would look like I was going to the prom, and she just looks amazing. So.
You mentioned custom making things for Jamila for the show. How many bolts of yellow and blue stripy fabric did you buy? How many outfits? Like, where did that begin? Is yellow and blue because of the University of Michigan? And one very creative friend of mine commented on the internet that she appreciated how you sort of built everybody's silhouette of what they would normally wear as a demon or as an inhabitant of neighborhood 12358W.
Yes.
Just using that fabric.
Correct, right. I love that friend of yours because that's exactly what we did, and you hope that people will notice. Mm-hmm. The blue and yellow chevron fabric, Mike picked the colors, and it is University of Michigan, and that's where his dad went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike is sweet like that. Like, every layer that you see has some personal meaning, and even if you don't know it, you feel it in all his shows, I feel. So mm-hmm. We ended up making that fabric. We made bolts and bolts of that fabric because that fabric doesn't exist at a fabric store. So, and the amount of fabric that we needed.
Right.
That is a dream for me to be able to like make bolts of fabric. You rarely get to do that.
What does that even mean? Do you go down to downtown Los Angeles and say, make me yards and yards of that? How do you do that?
I think it was Torrance.
Okay.
and you go to the fabric factory and you show them what you want it to look like, and they'll print a sample out and say this before they print hundreds and hundreds of yards of fabric, and you say yes, and then they start printing bolts of fabric. And once we got the bolts of fabric, we had a pretty big sewing room where we exactly patterned everything that everybody was wearing.
That's bananas.
And then sewed costumes that, you know, Ted is wearing a bow tie made of the fabric, a jacket exactly like the jacket he might have been wearing in a prior scene.
Right.
And so everybody is wearing their outfit in that particular fabric. The other thing that I love to say about that fabric is that for me, you know, Mike, he is so decisive. He makes decisions right away. And then so when he picked blue and yellow, I was thinking, like, how can I make sense with this, the blue and yellow, so that it feels right to me? And blue and yellow is the tease apart of green, which is the color of the good place. So blue and yellow equals green.
Mm-hmm.
Is this too much? You guys can
edit
this.
Are you kidding me?
But so what's happening in those scenes is the teasing apart of good and pulling those two colors away from each other.
Wow.
That would equal green.
Wow. Yeah.
But Mike did it without, he can just do that without even going there.
That's great.
Like, he came up with that. But he came up with blue and yellow, and then it's perfect because that is the common, that mm-hmm. combination equals green.
Do you know what it costs to make that fabric and those outfits?
You're saying this like you have the answer.
I don't.
Yes.
No. Oh, I'm sorry.
He's looking at my budget. I do not off the top of my head because that was season one, and I like to put those kind of numbers out of my head.
I'm sure. I mean, this is one of those evidences, one of those times in the show where, like, it wasn't a 2-second bit, but it was a pretty quick bit, and you've made, dozens of garments, right?
Yes, and that happens, when you're doing big scenes where you pour a lot of resources into a quick party scene or, mm-hmm. A wedding. There's always a wedding in something, and you spend a lot of money on those quick pops, but they mean so much. They stick with you. And we actually did end up using those costumes again.
Right, in season two, I think,
yes,
right?
In the beginning of season two, yes.
I think it was during the Dance Dance Resolution episode, was it? Like one of the reboots? Maybe not.
They were in a meeting room in Tahani's house, and they were wearing those costumes again, which we love. Anytime we spend money on something, we're like, yes, we get to use those again. And forever they sat in our office, wrote racks and racks of these blue and yellow costumes, which was
so funny.
Kind of fun, yeah.
These Good Place residents, ostensible Good Place residents, are also the ones that Eleanor turns to trying to figure out with her little point-counting device how she can get better.
Right.
Of course, she's faced with the reality that she's doing it for the wrong reasons, right?
Yeah. The idea of motivation is something that we've sort of struggled with because your point totals are sort of calculated through your actions, right? And so what if you do an action that is inherently good, but you have the wrong motivations for it? And in this particular episode, we see that, like, Eleanor is trying to be a good person. She's trying to be nice to everybody in the neighborhood, but that she's doing it completely for self-preservation. And so the idea that she actually, you know, comes to this realization that she actually has to leave in order for her to do any good at all— mm-hmm. Was, I think, something that we found in the room and then was reflected through that, like, as you said, the ticker that she sort of has and sort of gives her, you know, an idea of where she is points-wise.
Let's listen to a clip. Current episodes of The Good Place are available on NBC.com and the NBC app.
Now we shall hear from tonight's featured guest. She's kind, she's humble, she's the Walmart of friends. Did I use that word right? Eleanor Shellstraw.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eleanor. Original flavor, not new and improved. I know a lot of bad stuff has happened because of me, but I never meant to hurt you. So if I caused you any harm, I'm truly sorry.
That's nice, Eleanor, but I still crashed into a turkey carcass.
And I fell into a sinkhole.
And my dog got kicked into the sun. What can you possibly say to us that'll make up for your actions?
Poe Buddy's Nerfect?
Poe Buddy's Nerfect? That's hilarious.
Like, nobody's perfect with the letter switch.
That's very funny.
It's Nerfect.
So that's another example of a potentially expensive group scene where everybody is, including background actors, informed by their, you know, where they were from all over the world before they met the Good Place. That has to be a ton of work.
It's a ton of fun work.
Wow.
and I'm really actually being serious. To be able to dress different people from different countries, and they're all supposed to be good people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, eventually we find out who all this crowd of people are.
Mm-hmm. In season two.
In season two.
Oh, you're fine.
I'm okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking around. Have you all watched it? So we find out that all these people eventually that they're demons, but so they're all playing characters, good people, like the best people that you can imagine, you know, but almost annoyingly good.
Right.
Even to those of us that aren't Eleanor. And it was fun to really try to think about, like, what is this Peace Corps person wearing? What is this, you know, all these people that did so much good on Earth, what do they look like? And they're from various places. So that was just a creative, fun process.
How big's your team?
First, I'll say thank you to Alexis Jax, who's my costume supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have 10 to 12 people. And people always are surprised how big a costume team is. I think a lot of times when I talk to people that don't know the industry, they think that I'm doing everything, which is hilarious.
That's a ridiculous idea.
It is, because, you know, we have people sewing and we have people on set and we have people breaking down the next scripts and shopping and at costume houses. So our team is very big and lovely, the best.
Your team is legitimately the best in the business.
Oh.
I work a decent amount, and your team is the best.
Thank you.
It's true. There are other good ones, too. Andrew, Pobody's nerfect. Where did that come from? Is that a saying? I've never heard that before.
I think it is a saying. I don't know exactly where it came from. I know that we definitely came up with it in the room. I forget who did. Maybe it was Mike. But it is kind of funny, like, hearing it back because, as Kirsten was saying, they are demons. Mm-hmm. So, like, part of their torture is that they find this really lame thing that they know Eleanor secretly hates.
Right, she hates
like,
that, right?
Awesome. They think it's just great. And, you know, but at the time that you're watching it, you just think they're sort of like these Ned Flanders, and they just, like, think that it's the most clever thing they've ever heard.
Right.
One thing that I do hear a lot is, like, was your rap gift like a Pobody's Nerfect shirt?
Right.
Or something like that. And it is not. I don't think we got those, but we got pieces of clothing that I think we would actually wear, which is like fleeces, I think is what they were, with the neighborhood number on it.
Yes.
But one of my friends did, it was very nice of him, he made me a Pobody's Nerfect shirt and sent it to me.
Is that right?
It is. It was, I forget exactly what it looked like, but I remember it was bedazzled and it was way too small. So I gave it to Megan Amram. So now she has it and very, very occasionally wears it.
I will tell you that those fleeces that say The Good Place on the sleeve are delightful. Mm-hmm. Cast can't wear them. Because if you wear that to the supermarket, it feels like you're going, that's right. Yes, I am the person from the thing.
I hadn't thought of that. Oh, it must be so tough for you.
It is. It's very difficult to be accosted at the Whole Foods. Kirsten, I have heard before that there was an admonition not to dress anybody in red, lest anybody would sniff that they might be the devil.
That's correct. So I'm just singing Mike's praises throughout this podcast.
That's why you're here.
There are a lot of rules in the show, which, you know, people would think make your job harder, but they make your job easier and it makes it fun. So we were allowed to use green and we weren't allowed to use red. And when we get to the bad place, there's no green and we do use red. So we had these color rules and I don't know how many people picked up on them, but they worked for us, you know, making sense of where we were.
We've also heard about Jamila that she wasn't accustomed to wearing pants. I heard her say, like, I don't think I've ever worn pants before.
She does not love wearing pants, and we don't put her in a lot of pants. But although I will say we have put her in cargo pants a couple of times.
Well, you don't have to be cautious of that. That's aired. We've seen it.
That's aired, but you don't know season 3.
I don't. No.
And you all should watch it.
Andrew, in a flashback, we see how Jason dies, and it's because he and Pillboy have this great experiment. They're going to try to rob a place to make their lives better. The name tag on the police officer is Prawn Mandler.
Yes.
The officer's name is Prawn Mandler. Is that one of those times that Mike or someone just put their hands on the keyboard and began typing?
I think that is definitely Mike. he has a propensity for crazy character names. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I named him in the script that I turned in. I think his name was Officer.
Just
police officer. And then the next time I saw the script, it was Officer Prond Mandler. So yeah, that's not even, I think, the craziest Mike Schur name by a long shot. But I think we have him, and then we also have Susan in those scenes, who is Jen Statsky, one of the writers of the show.
One of the writers, that's right. We see the death of Jason in a safe, and he later realizes in a really touching and honest moment that he only realizes in this moment why a snorkel inside an airtight container wouldn't do him any good.
Yeah.
And he even says, I'm a moron. He says to Janet,
you shouldn't be with me.
You shouldn't be with
me. Yeah, yeah.
And then promptly forgets it, frankly.
I know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he has like the memory of a goldfish. I mean, Jason is such a sweet character. And I feel like if people want to see a master class in thoughtless emoting, they should watch Manny deliver that line. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. He goes, somebody who, and then he takes a pause and he goes, is just now realizing why that didn't work.
Yeah.
And it's as if, like, I mean,
you see him see it.
Yes, exactly. You see him realize why a snorkel in a safe is a bad idea for the very first time in his actor life.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so, like, innocent and sweet in that moment. And it's so funny. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
I also love the scene where he undergoes the lie detecting cube and almost defeats it, you know, by being honest. Like,
yeah,
he's saying banana stuff. And it's going, yep, that's true. Yep, that's true.
Yeah.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah.
And I think it just donks on him once. Like, it just...
Yeah, he kind of thinks in that scene, it seems like he almost thinks it is like a Family Feud type game where you have to buzz in as soon as possible,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to like a lie detector where you're really supposed to take your time with it and avoid lying or, you know, saying anything bad.
Right.
But yeah, he's very dumb.
The safe is a Swanson Safe Company safe.
Right.
That feels like it's not random.
Yeah, it's definitely not random. I'm sure that was a conversation that Mike had with the art department. But it's
also a reference to Parks and Recreation.
Yes,
to
it's
Ron
a reference
Swanson.
To Ron Swanson. But I also think it's funny because there have been, I think, a lot of conspiracy theories online that they now exist in the same universe, and that, mm-hmm, in fact the safe was bought directly from Ron Swanson's Swanson Safe Company. And, you know, it's awesome, I think, that the fans, like, are so interested and curious about our show. But sometimes you just want to be like, it's just a little joke.
Right,
like,
right.
Don't read too much into it. I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for Mike or any of the rest of the writers. But I don't think they take place in, like, the exact same universe.
Now, you know that the John Ralphio's fragrance or something was also on a magazine.
Well, there you go. I'm wrong.
I don't know. I'm not saying you're wrong.
From the
I'm just
show.
Saying, if the goal is not to poke the bear about conspiracy theories, like, there's some poking of the bear going on.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I think that it's funny, though, because sometimes, I mean, it has gotten to the point where, and this is actually, like, I think a great problem to have because it definitely keeps us on our toes as writers, but there are times when I think an episode airs and people really latch onto something, mm-hmm, and you're like, wow, we did not think that was going to be a big deal at all.
Right.
And then, but people are so invested in the show and are such fans of the show that they really are mentally cataloging everything, and that they're clocking things that even I, as a writer, am not, you know.
Some things seem pretty direct. I noticed that the name of the restaurant in this episode is, like, the Canteen of Heaven.
Yeah.
Like, that does seem like a pretty direct. So you wouldn't argue that there are Easter eggs that we're missing?
I would say that there are certainly Easter eggs in every episode, and I think that is deliberate. So maybe I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too. But I do think that sometimes there are, like, for example, you know, with the character names or whatever, a lot of times they're just very silly and they're just things that make us laugh, not necessarily meaning anything. Or, you know, I would say the things that actually matter the most are the philosophy parts. Like, that is actually something that the writers and Mike spend a lot of time on. And so, like, if someone is reading a book or someone's, you know, there's a lesson plan on the chalkboard or something like that, that actually does thematically fit into the episode.
It tracks,
sort of,
right?
Tells you where the episode is going and where the season's going, because we have, like, a couple of consulting people who are philosophers and philosophy professors who we talk to at the beginning and during every season, who sort of hold our hand and tell us who Kant is and sort of walk us through those things, because ultimately a lot of times those concepts form sort of the spine to a lot of these episodes, mm-hmm, and sort of as a guide for what the characters are feeling and what the themes are.
This is another great opportunity that you've taken to talk about Florida and Jacksonville. J-Town, easily one of the top 10 swamp cities in northeastern Florida. It's difficult for me to decide who is the dumbest, Jason, Pillboy, or later Derek.
Yeah, I would say Derek is like a malformed human being.
True.
So probably Derek, but you're certainly right. I mean, like, the fact that I rewatched the episode last night just to refresh my memory. And the fact that, like, Pillboy and Jason, the end of that scene is them racing to the bathroom to see who can diarrhea first.
Right.
That's bad.
No, that's like, best friendship.
That's really bad. That's bad for them. It's bad for Florida. It's bad for the show. It's really bad. But yeah, it's funny. They're very dumb in different ways. I mean, I don't know if Jason would necessarily show up and start using an Italian accent, but that's pretty dumb.
That's pretty pillboy.
Yeah, that's pretty pillboy.
This episode takes us in a couple of interesting directions. We meet arguably the best character, Sean, and and then there, of course, is the confirmation of what Eleanor was hoping for, that there exists what she terms a medium place.
Yes.
And we will be speaking very soon with Mindy St. Clair about that as well.
Yeah.
Kirsten, why are fedoras so terrible? Is that you that paints that as a bad place thing?
I think that's Mike.
Is it?
I'm gonna pin that on him so that all the fedora-wearing people aren't mad at me. Sorry, everybody.
Andrew Law, what's good?
Oh, my God. I knew this question was coming. I just totally did not even think about it. What's good? Fried chicken.
Oh.
I love... that's like, I would, if I could, I would eat it all the time.
You can. Kirsten Mann, what's good?
I'm going to say my teenage son, Charlie, because good is complicated. And it's hard to decide what is good. And I'm going to just say that.
I think that anybody that's ever been a teenager or the parent of a teenager can relate to what you're saying.
Right.
Andrew and Kirsten, thank you so much. This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good.
Hi there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay!